Hello, everyone, and welcome. Welcome to Season 4 of the Power, Privilege and Allyship podcast. My name is Funke Abimbola, and I'm the CEO and founder of the Austin Bronte Consultancy, a global consulting firm whose main goal is to improve leadership by leveraging the impact of diversity, inclusion, belonging, and equity across the business world. My son, Max Abimbola, is co-host of the podcast and a first-year computer science student at Newcastle University. Now, as our regular listeners will know, Max does, of course, interview with me as much as he can, but he can't join us today because he's got a lecture. So I think that's, once again, a fair enough excuse. I would much rather he prioritises his degree. But I do promise that Max will be back again very, very soon. Now, today I have the tremendous joy of interviewing a really special lady, a former work colleague, Natalie. It's such a delight to have you with us on the podcast. Welcome.
Oh, thank you for asking me. I feel genuinely honoured to be part of it. I've been listening to the series and it's amazing the people that you've had on with such incredible stories. So thank you.
Well, yours is also an incredible story, Natalie. I mean, you and I go back a very long way. We won't say how far back, but we met at a previous employer many years ago. And I'd love you to, first of all, introduce yourself, Natalie, to our wider audience before we move on with the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you say, we met through the pharmaceutical industry. So I kind of did the usual thing of being at university and did biology. I actually started with law, which not many people know. And the scientist in me just rebelled against all of that reading. I'll be totally honest, in statutes. I swapped over to the sciences. Again, I rebelled against medicine. My family, I've got quite a few doctors and I was adamant not to be a doctor as well. Don't know why. But when you have a biology degree, I always feel that you either become a teacher or you go into the pharmaceutical industry, and I chose the one that paid more money is the really brutal way of saying about it. You know, you're a 20-something year old and someone goes, we will offer you this job where you get this lovely car, lovely salary, you know, and you're part of the industry. And it's been, you know, it's a fascinating industry, as you know yourself. And, you know, worked across with two very major pharmaceutical companies and saw all sorts of insights. I've done the sales side, I've done the training side, I've done the medical affairs side. And to sort of see different medicines come through development, and I'm sure you can relate to this, and you always can be like proud, you know, when you sort of see drugs that, you know, have gone through their life and been in it so long that drugs that you launched are now being sold over the counter, which for people listening, that generally is quite a long time period. So it goes to show I've been around quite a while. So my life was very much around a corporate world, a good career. I had two children from a first marriage, and then I got divorced back in 2013. And to be honest, at that point, I was sort of mid to late 30s, thought probably my childbearing years were behind me, that I got these two beautiful daughters and didn't have the need to have really any more children. And then I met with my partner at the time, Bobby, and he was somebody I'd known for a long time. We'd known each other through our grammar school days. We had mutual friends who were all ended up married because they all ended up at the same university, etc., etc. This big circle of friends together. We got together later in life, about a year after I got divorced, just through let's go for a drink, through social media, let's meet up, lovely to catch up. We lived in the same area, and what was going to be a casual drink sort of turned into this romance, this very intense romance. But as what happened with second serious relationships that happens in the world today, that the family question comes up again. He had no children. So all of a sudden, I'm now in a position of later 30s. And my partner at the time is saying, well, actually, I really would like a child. And as you can imagine, for me, that was, okay, that's quite a consideration. I've got a really good career. I wasn't thinking about breaking at this point to have another child. But you make those decisions. I thought, why not? I'm the youngest of three. It'd be nice to have my children have two siblings rather than just one. And so we went ahead and had that. And I always remember I got pregnant very quickly, and that was a really, really big surprise. You know, there they are sort of saying, oh, you take a long time to get pregnant. And it does for some women in later years. And no, it didn't at this point. I remember being quite a bit of shock as I was going through my pregnancy. I was full pelt career, still at work, doing management training courses, traveling up and down to Hertfordshire and places like that, and all over. I live in the Midlands, so it was all up and down the motorway. And almost in denial, I think, at one point about my pregnancy and the fact that I was going to be a 40-year-old mum with three children and one was going to be a small baby. And there was a slight element of fear about that, thinking my friends had all moved on in effect in their lives, and therefore I was going to be, who would I meet up with when you have your children to start with? You meet up with the other mums of your age, but that was kind of gone. But that was never really in the end to be a consideration for me, because as I neared my maternity leave, in fact, literally the Friday before my maternity leave was due to start on the Monday, my world turned upside down. And what seemed a very happy bubble of nice house, let's say nice career, loving partner, we were living together with marriage plans, etc., literally blew apart within a matter of hours. I'll let you step in and ask anything you want at that
point. Yes, yes. It's there's a bit that I'd love to unpack there around what you've just shared, because you've touched on so many themes that will resonate with many of our listeners. You know, many of our listeners are parents, you know, they have care responsibilities. As we both know, that tends to fall on the woman, whoever's actually given birth to the child, generally speaking. You know, of course, there are exceptions. And with that come all these considerations that you do need to weigh up. And the other thing that you've mentioned is, of course, if it's a second serious relationship, which I thought was a really, really important point, thinking through that, the impact that then has when it's a bit later on in your career than you would have expected. Perhaps that fed into the sense of not really wanting to think too much about it, Natalie. I mean, I'm sort of putting words into your mouth, but what do you think about that?
And I think that's absolutely true. I mean, you know, I've just been, the company that I was working for at the time, the one where we'd met, you know, they'd put me on their management aspirational manager program. I'd gone through that, been successful. I was then doing what they call a field training management role, which was sort of, you know, on the management level and career. So I was kind of on this trajectory where I was going down that avenue because I thought, although my children were only 10 and 6 when what happened to me happened, but there was starting to be at a stage where you weren't with that sort of very small baby. And I think any professional woman understands, you know, that the demands are very different as your child goes through different ages. And when you're suddenly thinking, well, that's kind of where I thought my career was going, and management, we do know, especially say in the pharmaceutical industry, where we're called, what we say, out in the field, because we're traveling about to different places. We have sales representatives who live in different parts of the country. It's, you know, you can't do that with a very, very small baby. It's very challenging to. So, yeah, when this whole topic of shall we have a baby, I thought, well, this isn't just shall I have a baby? This is, well, I'm going to be nearly 40. Shall I change my career plans, or shall I change what? Because actually the next 5 to 6 years and then I'm going to be nearing 50. And then what will that have implications of? And will that get me viewed differently? So, yeah, a lot of things to think about there.
Yes, yes, certainly, Natalie. So let's pick up from where we were. What happened? What happened, Natalie, in your own words, this fateful day?
Yeah, so it was Friday, the 4th of March, 2016, and it started as a really ordinary day. I'd actually taken a week's annual leave. I was using up some annual leave before my maternity leave, and the week had been fairly hectic. I'll be totally honest, my eldest daughter had been ill, so I'd been home with her, and I'd got various midwife appointments. I'd been in hospital having a few contractions, so it's kind of been a bit of a crazy week. And the weird thing is that Friday was going to be my first calm day before I hit the weekend, and obviously, you know, chaos with having two children already and everything. Yeah, I woke up as normal next to my partner, who dashed off to work, was, you know, nothing to notice that there was anything different there, kissing me goodbye, kissing my two girls goodbye. I dashed off to school, took them, did the usual thing. It was my eldest daughter's assembly, so did the usual thing that all parents do, sat there filming, taking photographs. I sat with my ex-husband, who I've got a very good relationship with, their dad, always maintained that. What was just ordinary day, shopping, things like that. I received a phone call from my partner to ask me to go and meet him in the town centre that afternoon to go to the bank. And actually, he first of all said he'd come and pick me up, that he wanted to make sure that I was looking after myself, that he knew I'd been dashing about all day, that I'd obviously, he's like, you've just been in hospital, you're 8 months pregnant, just slow down, which isn't really coming to my vocabulary, as you know, because you know me well. Slowing down does not really happen. And I remember saying to him, no, I will walk into the town centre. And he kept insisting he'd pick me up. Now, luckily, I'm a very stubborn lady. I'm half Portuguese. I always say I've got quite a strong Latina temperament. So I'm very strong-willed. I always blame that. It's probably not true at all, but it's the easiest thing for me to say. And luckily, my partner was running late, or what I foresaw to be late. So I decided to set off anyway. And I remember phoning him in my mind, semi-triumphantly, that I was actually walking, which is what I wanted to do. And he answered the phone. And again, nothing to implement. There was anything strange going on. He talked to me calmly, as in just apologetic that he was running late. He was stuck in traffic, that he was on the other side of Birmingham, that, you know, was I okay? I was reassured him, I'm absolutely fine. I'm going to walk into the town centre. I'm going to do some shopping. A good friend of mine was about to, one of my best friends was about to get married. I wanted to get her card. And his final words were, I love you. And I said, I love you too. So again, totally oblivious in my own little world, as you do, walking into town centre, about a 20-minute walk. It was raining. I got my umbrella up, kind of regretting that I hadn't taken the car because my baby bump was starting to get wet because it's being 8 months pregnant, it's poking right out of my jacket. And as I reached the town centre, I decided to take a shortcut because of the rain behind this churchyard, which when I say a shortcut, it always makes it sound quite sort of seedy, but it wasn't, you know, it's a wide, it is a pedestrianised area, like an alleyway, but it's quite wide and tree lined. And, you know, people use it a lot to go back and forth to the town centre because the other way around is in front of the church. And that's quite a long walk, which in the rain was not ideal. So I head off down this place called Trinity Hill. And I'm halfway down the pedestrianised cover bit right behind this church graveyard. And I hear these footsteps running behind me and kind of that alert. And I think, you know, probably a lot of listeners on here will relate to that fact where your heart starts to pound a bit. You feel uncomfortable. There's somebody in your space or feeling like they're advancing into your space. And I glanced over my shoulder and all I saw was this very scruffy, quite big built fellow with a hoodie on. And he got the hood pulled right up and over his head. So I sped up and I thought, if I can just get out of here and into the open, it was opened out into this dead end road, which there were cars parked up and there's a man walking up this hill. So I thought, I'll be all right. I'll be safe. So I did. I started to power walk as best as I could, 8 months pregnant, down this hill and got out into the open. And just as I started to sigh a breath of relief, really, just like, goodness. I realised that this man's now walking right behind me, as in he's so in my physical space, I can almost feel him. And I stepped to one side to be very clear, as if to say, go on, go past, honestly, just go past. And just as I stepped to one side and nodded to him, almost like, after you, all I felt was this thump as he grabbed me, because he jumped on me literally from behind and pulled me backwards. And as you can imagine, you're in this moment of complete paralysis, and then your brain is obviously firing everything out, this fight, flight, friend, flop, all the other F's that come with it, freeze. I tried to fight him off, to be totally honest, couldn't fight him off. He'd gripped me very, very tightly. I thought I was being mugged. It was the obvious thing in my head. My handbag was on the side that he was grabbing me from. So I'm desperately trying to get my handbag off my shoulder because, you know, I'm 8 months pregnant. For me, it's take my bag, please just go, you know, nothing's worth this. And this is a trigger warning ahead for your listeners, is that as I tried to get my bag off, as I glanced to my right hand side, I suddenly saw his right hand draw up with a 12-inch carving knife, and within a split second he brought that down and began to attack me and stab me repeatedly. And life went into slow-mo and I couldn't break free. I screamed for help. Luckily, two passers-by did intervene. And at one point, I had two men had jumped on him and we were all on the floor and there's four of us on the floor, two men trying to pull him off me and he's still carrying on. And now I've gone into the stage of fear where we call friends. So I was actually talking to the attackers, you know, trying to reason with him, you know, sort of, you go into this like logical state, like, why me? What have I done to you? What? I'm pregnant. And I remember saying all these things to him because I was thinking I just wanted to try and relate. And there was nothing. He said nothing. He just carried on with what he was doing and luckily broke free at one point. I don't know how I managed to get to my feet. I guess the adrenaline in our bodies is an incredible thing. I got to my feet and didn't get very far. I tried to call for help before I collapsed. And the attacker, unfortunately, he too broke free from the two men who were holding him, and he proceeded to continue with the attack. And I was conscious again at this point. I'd come around and I was leaning myself against a brick wall, which was this entryway into a car park. And he basically advanced upon me, and I couldn't do anything apart from put my arm around myself to protect myself. But he continued, and at one point I thought, this is it. And no matter how much begging I did with him, it didn't make any odds. And luckily, an 18-year-old young man who is just incredible, he heard the shouts for help. The two guys who had been holding him, the older of the two guys, had gone shouting into the town centre. Because we were literally a stone's throw from all the bus stops and McDonald's. This is now just gone 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Friday afternoon. You can imagine it's absolutely packed. And, you know, of all the people that the person shouting for help was calling out to, he said there were so many people, only one person reacted. And I know there's a thing called bystander theory where people always think that someone else will come. And yes, this 18-year-old ran across the road. He ran up the hill. He saw me on the floor covered in blood, but he didn't even realise that the attacker had a knife, and he rugby tackled him off at him. And he was followed, thank goodness, by three police officers. Again, complete chance. They happened to be on foot patrol in the town centre. They heard the shouts for help. Never normally happens. And as they came around the corner, they found the attacker over me for a third time. So he was coming back again to continue, and they arrested him on the spot. And in total, it was 9 minutes. And in those 9 minutes, I've been stabbed 24 times. So, as you can imagine, nobody had the odds that I was going to survive. The police have been very honest with me since. They sort of said we really did take the place to be a murder scene, because we did not believe there was any chance that you were going to survive. So I was very lucky. They started first aid immediately. Obviously, they were calling through to the ambulance. There were now other people calling. Once the police had arrived, it was an interesting, I guess it's almost like a sociological experiment. I know that the guy who'd originally been calling for help, he said, bearing in mind only one person came when I shouted for help, he said, once the police were there, he said, you think that the gates, now I'm a, like I say, a Birmingham girl. So he said the gates, it was like the gates to Villa Park had opened. He said, because the surge of people that came up, all to stand by and watch and things like that. And it's quite sad, I guess, really, that there's that mentality that nobody would help him until that point when he was calling for help. But to come to my aid, but luckily the one person did come. So yeah, I was airlifted out of the town centre, and Midlands Air Ambulance charity helicopter came down. They airlifted me on one lung. They would never normally do that, but they said time was so critical. They said, you are our worst case scenario, Natalie. They said, you had many central stab wounds, you were 8 months pregnant, and you had one lung. So we would never, ever dream of airlifting someone in that condition. But it was a case of airlift you immediately or lose you at the site. And they said we had to take that risk. And when we landed at the hospital, they reckon I had probably less than 5 minutes. They thought it was touch and go if I was going to make the landing. And I do remember, I remember coming down. In fact, I remember taking off, and I remember thinking, oh, I don't like flying. And I thought, best not tell them. Best not tell them. Not time to mention that I don't like flying. But I remember touching down, and we touched down at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital, which weirdly was a hospital that I went to a lot with my own work. So it's one that I recognised. So there were parts that I recognised. And it's a strange fact. It's a beautiful, very modern hospital, brilliant hospital, major trauma centre. They bring a lot of the army troops have gone there. It's a big military hospital. But for some reason, they've built the air, the landing strip, the helicopter pad is on top of a car park opposite the building. So they have to take you down in the lift. And then they crossed you across the road on a zebra crossing. And I remember being half gone out of it, literally unable to breathe pretty much. And seeing this man, I will never forget this man in his high-vis jacket holding the traffic. And they were bumping me across the zebra crossing to go into A&E, which is ludicrous when you think about it. It's state-of-the-art hospital and the helipads across the road. So, yeah, they ran me to theatre, straight into theatre, 5 hour surgery, put into a coma, transferred into critical care. They delivered my baby. During that now, the knife had struck me abdominally. He had purposely, the attacker purposely put the knife abdominally as well as within my chest, but and the knife missed her by 2 millimetres. So she was assumed to be passed when they delivered her, and they did have to resuscitate her. Again, didn't think that they would be able to. But they managed to bring her around, and then they put her into a coma, but transferred her to a different hospital. So when I came out of my coma, first news unbroken is you have a daughter, which is amazing news, but she's in another hospital and she's fighting for her life. So as a parent, you're kind of, I'm strapped to all these tubes. I can't move. I was very aware that I was still in a very critical condition that I might not make the next few days. And they're telling you, well, you have this baby, but she's in a totally different hospital to you, which is every parental instinct is your baby's fighting for her life. You want to be there and you couldn't be there. But then I noticed this, and it's a weird thing, that there was no friendly faces around my bed, as in there was no family. So my partner wasn't there, my mum wasn't there, my sisters weren't there. And I realised that, you know, this is, you know, at least a day on from when I've, and it was the next day from when I've gone down. So there's plenty of time for people to be there. And they were just surrounded by very formal looking police officers. And they were lovely, the police officers. That's not putting down West Midlands police, were incredible. And they asked me questions, obviously, about the attack. I told them what I remembered. And that's when they brought the devastating news that it was actually my partner that they were holding in the police station. He had been arrested, obviously, on scene. He was in disguise, which is why I'd had to struggle identifying him. He'd got multiple layers of clothing. He even went so far as he put a rucksack underneath his top to pad himself out. That's why he looked so big, because he's quite a slim fellow, quite big. In his rucksack, he had spare clothes, he had spare shoes, he had two pairs of gloves, so everything to disguise. So it's a premeditated attack. And in that few moments, I remember lying there and feeling that everything was crumbling away. And the preceding, you know, weeks, months, you know, having to go through, you're a patient in hospital, you're severely ill, but you're having to have video interviews with the police. The world media, you know, and it was as far as the world. I had friends in Australia who heard the story, you know, press is going crazy about it. I'm worrying about my other two children who are 10 and 6 and what impact that's having on them. But I don't want them to come into hospital to see me because I was so badly injured. I didn't want them to see that. So I'm talking to them on the phone. Yeah. So happy bubble to utter destruction within a matter of moments.
It's just unfathomable. I mean, I know this. We had the same employer at the time. I was involved in all sorts of things that, as an employer, and indeed a big family, as we saw ourselves at that company, felt we wanted to do, not that we had to do, but that we wanted to do to support you. And I know your story, Natalie. And yet I'm listening to this again, and I am just horrified. It just seems so unfathomable that this could even have happened. But for those of our listeners for whom this may have been a trigger in some way, what I'll do at this point is I will reference the fact that I will put in the show notes a link to Natalie's TEDx. She's done a really, really amazing TEDx, which goes into even more detail around this. And Natalie's also written a book about her experiences as well. So I'm very conscious we're discussing some very sensitive issues, and I don't want any of our listeners to, or indeed, you know, you or I, even Natalie, frankly, because it's not easy for either of us to discuss this. But you went through a horrific experience, Natalie. Where are you now?
Yeah, and it has been a journey, you know, these past few years. Weirdly, it's been a journey. When people say journey of discovery, that always makes me slightly cringe because it sounds very cliched and everything else. But strangely enough, before what happened to me happened, I'd started to feel that although the pharmaceutical industry is a wonderful industry on many levels, and, you know, let's be honest, you know, where we are with cancer, HIV, everything else like that, you know, where we're getting them to become more chronic conditions, they're not life sentences necessarily anymore, things like that. There's an incredible industry that has been able to provide that for people. But for me, I felt I always, even before, you know, my attempted murder, I very much felt I wanted to do something different, as in I wanted to do something more direct to help people. So weirdly, what happened to me was the catalyst for me to say, well, actually, do you know what? I remember lying in hospital and actually thinking, do you know, I could have literally died on that hill. And I realized I'd been traveling all over the country. I hadn't seen my children as much because I was constantly having to go in and out of different hotels, as we can do with work. And And I thought, actually, this is a great industry, but this is not my love and passion. And what if I died doing something that really was my love and passion? And okay, I would have earned good money and I've got a nice house for my family, but really, does that count for everything? And I felt it hadn't. And I was going on this journey of discovery anyway after the attack, because I had to, my ex-partner pleaded guilty to attempted murder. And therefore, the police did turn around to me and say, well, we don't really have to dig for a motive because he's pleaded guilty. And they said, I know that doesn't help you, Natalie, because I know you really want to understand, and you know, different motives were given. But I started to really investigate it and uncover all this double life. Then I started writing it down because I felt people, the press were talking about it. Some people asked me some horrific questions to my face, and I felt I wanted the truth to be out there. And so that's when I started writing my book. And as you say, then I did my TEDx on the back of that in 2019. And that's when I started to get into speaking. And weirdly, this complete, and maybe the wonders of social media, really, somebody on Twitter contacted me and said, Natalie, we can see you're a victim of a stabbing and we see that you do speaking. Would you come to our unit? And it was a pupil referral unit, so for where when students get permanently excluded from mainstream education, they get to a pupil referral unit, and it's really kind of just to help them get some basic GCSEs. They don't go full-time. It's sort of very relaxed hours, and a lot of these young people have quite significant behavioral issues. And they said, would you come to this unit, talk to our students about the reality of being a stab victim? And I must admit, Funky, I was like, what? I'm I was like 42 or whatever. I'm thinking, I'm a 42-year-old woman who comes from this pharmaceutical, what, with really quite a privileged background like that, you know, as in good money and things, and I'm going to go and try and speak to these young people who've come from such tough backgrounds, and they're going to just look at me and think, who the heck is she? We're not going to listen to her. I was like, okay, they got anything. Yep, let's go and see how it is. And something just lit inside of me, because I went and I talked to them and they related beautifully. We had some really honest discussions. I saw barriers being broken down, and it evolved from there, my work with young people, really. And I started going into more pupil referral units and schools and colleges, and then some young offender units have contacted me. And I'm just, as we're recording this, in a couple of weeks' time, I'll be going to a young adult prison to do a similar thing. And the story, I realised, started to connect with people, and that whole narrative of, I'm going to say the reality of being a stab victim. So they do get a very harsh version, I'll be honest. They do get very detailed. But also that sort of honesty of, you know, we can't put labels on who could be a victim. And actually anybody could be a victim. And young people take all sorts from it. Some take the angle around domestic abuse from it and being a victim of that or a survivor of that, because a lot of these young people have been touched by that in their lives. Some it is purely just around the knife and carrying a knife, and we have discussions, but it's that open and very honest. I realized that because of my background, I was like, I want to understand their world better. And you know, and I had to put my hands up, you know, I'm a white woman who came from a very middle class area, and I thought, yeah, I want to be able to understand better about what's happening. And I started to do did a gangs and youth violence course, so I could really look at all the different impacts, and met some incredible people who along the way, who sort of youth workers and urban youth specialists and people with lived experience within that life. And it really made me start to look at the underlying factors, you know, why do young people carry knives? Why do young people resort to gang membership or start carrying drugs on county lines? And kind of my world now is very much focused around working with young people. I still do a lot of talks around reality of knife crime, but also looking around trauma. And my next sort of thing is very much like my passion, and my next project and goal is to, I'd love to set up some form of centre around trauma. We all know that CAMHS, so the Children and Adolescent Mental Health Service, is woefully under-resourced and woefully stretched. And I saw it with my own daughters, the impact that the trauma of what happened to me, what I was doing to them. And they were quite privileged, really. I was able to pay for a psychologist. So where CAMHS couldn't provide, I paid for a psychologist. They had mentors because they went to a nice school, so they had mentors. But I still saw my middle daughter, for example, having behavioural issues. And I thought, well, what if you're a young person who comes from an underprivileged background where you've got nobody on your side, in effect, you know, and nobody can pay these bills. The private psychologist is really big money. And, you know, we've got these young people who are dealing with such terrible things in their brains that obviously it manifests itself in all sorts of behaviours, which then gets a negative circle because they do these behaviours, they'll get excluded from mainstream education, and then they are more vulnerable to other extrafamilial harms and things like gangs, county life, sexual exploitation, etc. And I'm kind of thinking, well, unless we can go in there and try and help them, and one element that I'm focusing in is, would like to be, is trauma, and say, how can we help them look at trauma, understand what's happening, understand what's going on in the brain, but help them process it and deal with it? I had a psychologist myself for 3.5 years. If I hadn't have had that, I wouldn't be in the position I am today. And that's what I'd love to now, is kind of go upstream, as the late great Sir Desmond Tutu would have said, you know, it's about, can we go upstream and try and stop these young people from falling in, rather than just pulling them out at the bottom of the system? And that's very much, so it's kind of, it's evolving still. It's very much an evolutionary cycle.
Yes, yes. And I'll be very sure again to leave your contact details, Natalie, in the show notes, and links to your websites and so on, because I know from our global audience of thousands now, there will be somebody who will contact you about this and taking this through. I'm confident that that will be the case. And there's so much you've already said about bias. You know, that this episode will be coming out during Women's History Month. It's going to be part of the Break the Bias series, which we now know is the theme for International Women's Day this year. You had a bit of a journey around the sort of domestic violence aspect of this, didn't you, Natalie? Do you want to unpack some of that for us?
Oh, absolutely. So if you talked to me in the first, I'd say, 3 years at least post my attempted domestic homicide, I would actually have said to you, I'm not a victim of domestic abuse. What are you talking about? And I had many, so I had magazines, for example, or shows or network on TV who would contact me, and they'd run to run my story. Yeah, that's fine. Because we're going to do a piece about domestic abuse. I'd be like, whoa, hang on, pardon? Well, I wouldn't link me to domestic abuse. And I literally remember I wouldn't link me to domestic abuse, because, you know, it was just that one-off incident. I look back now and I laugh at myself going, oh my gosh, I was so terrified. If I'm going to be really, really honest, I was terrified to have the label of domestic abuse survivor, or domestic abuse, violence abuse, as it DVA, as it's now sort of coming down to. I felt, after what happened to me, obviously there was already a lot of people talking, it was in the press, people obviously, we're human beings, we always want to make sense of things, don't we? We always want to try and put a reason, because it makes it easier if we can put a reason to something. So I felt there was judgment and stigma there already. And I thought, if I then say, well, actually, yeah, do you know what? Yeah, I am the victim of domestic abuse, then that would have added to that stigma. And I already felt fairly weak and powerless in those first couple of years, because you're trying to build yourself up. You know, you've literally had everything blown apart for you. And I thought, no, I refuse. And it was purely a turning point of meeting a wonderful woman through a professional net, obviously networking sites like with LinkedIn and things. And it was actually one of my LinkedIn contacts who said, I want you to meet this lady. She runs this domestic abuse community interest company. You know, I think you two would get on really well. And I was a bit hesitant. I was just like, oh, gosh, here we go again. Spoke to her, and we now do a lot of work together, her and I. And I remember her reframing it in my head of just like, Natalie, it's incredible. You survived one of the UK's worst attempted domestic homicides, and it's incredible what you survived. And all of a sudden I was thinking, hold on, she's talking about it like it's something to be proud of, and I'd never thought of it as something to be proud of. And I realised it's my own unconscious bias about how I viewed victims of domestic abuse, and that's just being as plain as I can to say I have my own unconscious bias about it, and actually that was seeping out and affecting and stopping me from relating to it. Whereas now I can say, well, actually, yes, because my ex-partner genuinely obviously manipulated me. He led a double life, as I discovered. So there was obviously a degree of coercive control that I'd never seen or wanted to admit to. And then obviously culminating in attempted domestic homicide, both of myself and my daughter. So but it was a journey. It was a massive journey. And one I've only in these last couple of years, I'd say, be able to stand up proud and go, yeah, that is me.
And that journey of discovery is one that will be ongoing, you know, for you, for me. I mean, I've already listening to this yet again in a very different context. This has triggered different thinking for me again. And as you know, I'm developing my own thinking around this, and I'm sort of seeing things, reframing certain aspects of so much of your story, Natalie, you know. And you've already touched on privilege. You've talked about how having the privilege meant that you were able to get support in various ways that wouldn't have been the case. But allyship is also a very strong theme here, isn't it? I mean, the men that got involved in trying to hold off your attacker, the policeman, what do you think about allyship as a concept, Natalie?
It's something that I think in the corporate world we always touched upon. Oh, we've got to work together, we're a team, we pull together and things like that. I would say actually even more acute, and absolutely there's examples you say with the men who stepped in and the police officers and things. But what I, in my journey since with everything I've been doing and stepping out into my own community interest company and working with young people, I've realised it's absolutely critical. You know, I am one person, I've got one focus, I can talk to young people about one area. But if we're going to make an actual change to young people's lives, we've got to come together. It's going to have to be people bringing in their different elements. And it's that bringing together those different elements. You know, this evening I'm going to be talking on part of a gangs network, which sounds really dodgy, doesn't it, when I say that? I'm meeting with my gang network.
Natalie.
It does, honestly. It's like, wow, gosh, that's terrible. So specialists who work in the gang arena with prevention, obviously, or getting people out of that situation. And we say, you know, we have to come together because people bring their different skills. And it's only been by that sort of bringing together of different skill sets and working together that, you know, I've been able to be involved in some amazing projects, and I'm planning amazing projects, you know. And it's like the gentleman on LinkedIn, the friend of mine who linked me with Lucy, who's the woman I work with through the other community interest company, domestic abuse, you know, that it's actually we come together and now we can bring in different narratives, we can bring together and create change. So I think, I mean, allyship to me is it's completely critical, because not one of us can make fundamental big changes and differences, no matter how great we are. You know, even if you're superwoman, you need everyone will bring their own skill set. And never more have I appreciated allyship than now. And what's a nice position now is that I have people in the early days who introduced me to people and said, oh, Natalie, they might be able to help you. They could give you advice, basically, how to set up your community interest company. Speak to this man here from the council or whatever. He can help you, or speak to them. But now people come to me and say, well, Natalie, can you help me with this? And if I can't do it, I go, okay, but I know someone, I can link you up to somebody else. And it's lovely to be part of that chain now of giving forward, you know, as well as sort of, I still have to help, get help. I still have to, you know, receive help. I work together with people. They help me and I help them. That's a nice reciprocal relationship, almost symbiotic, really, in cases. But be able to pay forwards. And that's what I see, you know, the true work of allyship is being able to have your community and be able to pass around. And that community being diverse, which certainly the community I work with is exceptionally diverse.
Yes, I mean, the Midlands generally, you know, is I always love visiting the Midlands. I love the vibrancy of the mix of cultures. And it's just wonderful that you've mentioned that as being something that you see as being a real strength within all of this.
Absolutely. And I mean, I'll mention here, if people look at my story, my partner was from a different cultural background to myself. And it's well documented in the press and it's very, very public and open. And it was actually given as a reason in court that his cultural background had caused him to have this temporary adjustment disorder, which is complete nonsense. And, you know, it got me very cross. He was just a very manipulative man, you know, with, you know, obviously psychological issues, who felt he lost control and wanted to do what he did. And culture was brought into it. Now, obviously, when I talk in schools and the, you know, the young people say, oh, but miss, why did he do it? Why did he do it? I'm always very open up front and say to them, if you look in the press, you're going to see this narrative. However, I do not want that ever to be, you know, thought of or formed, you know, and I'll speak very openly about the culture that he was part of. And I'll talk about, you know, I've got great friends within the culture that he came from. And I sort of said, it is not representative of that culture. And I'm always very keen to make sure that that's forward. And, you know, and I have people from that culture come forward to me afterwards and they'll say to me, thank you so much for putting that forward, you know, because obviously I don't want to leave that school and have kids look it up and then cause issues for children, because I do talk to a whole diverse range of cultures and backgrounds. And, you know, and I said, crikey, I said, you know, I come from a white Catholic background. If you want people who are a judgmental culture, trust me, you know, my nan was terrible, you know, because I said, so it doesn't matter what colour, what religion, anything you're from, there can be biases within that. You know, it's, that's just how it is. And it's, you know, where hopefully we'll move to a future world where there's greater acceptance and greater blending. We're slowly getting there, but there's so many issues still along the way. But I'm always very keen to make sure that it is expressed up front, because I do speak to such a diverse, and it is wonderful diversity, because you know what, you talk to these young people, the insecurities are still the same, the driving factors of the wanting to be accepted, the, you know, the thing that does change, which I find utterly, utterly heartbreaking, is sometimes the perception of some young people about what they think they can achieve. And especially when they come from more deprived areas, and, you know, irrelevant of skin colours or anything else, but from deprived areas where they feel there is no future for them. And it's trying to help them believe you can, if we get you connected with the right people, you have the right self-belief. It only takes one person to make that change for somebody, that one person to believe. And we have some incredible people out working with young people who do that all the time, but we need more. We need more youth workers and to help young people see the potential they've got.
Yes, yes. That's such a, that's a really, really strong call to action there for us to finish our discussion on. I can't believe how quickly the time has flown by, Natalie, but I cannot thank you enough, Natalie, for this, truly. You know, there's just so much that we've been able to cover in this very limited time. And I just only hope I've done you justice, Natalie, with this episode.
Oh, just many, many thanks for having me on. It's just an absolute, I love talking to you always, so absolute pleasure.
And with that, our lovely listeners, our time is once again up and we need to say goodbye for now. But I look forward very much indeed to my next truly fascinating, insightful and indeed inspiring conversation with yet another fearless and amazing leader, just like Natalie. Thanks very much, everyone, and goodbye for now.